modulating. It had been made, according to Cyrielle, without magic but influenced by the unrealist school nonetheless. If Sloane had believed in souls, she would have hoped that Cameron's existed in Genetrix, that he was an architect building houses that defied logic and sense. But she didn't. Sometimes she still hoped anyway. Cyrielle was walking with Matt at the front of the group. Esther was teaching Edda and their third chaperone, Perrin, how to say something in Korean. Kiro saw Sloane lingering by Warner Tower and stayed behind to wait for her, his hands in his coat pockets. "Did you have any luck today?" he asked. "As far as I'm concerned, my siphon is just a really expensive paperweight," Sloane said. She glanced over her shoulder, sure she had just heard something buzzing. But the street behind her was empty. Kiro smiled grimly. "Well, at least you know you can do something. Some people don't have the ability at all." "What do they do?" She jogged a little to catch up to him. The streets were packed with cars, some as old-fashioned as the taxi she had taken with Esther, and some that looked like little bubbles with wheels. "Move to Haven Cities?" "Oh, so you know about those." "Mox, you know, that bartender friend I made, said he was from one." She had stayed away from Mox since that conversation, sensing that she had made a critical misstep but not understanding what. It hadn't occurred to her that she could just ask Kiros what she had done wrong. He said he had to learn not to destroy things with magic as a kid, so he moved up here. Kiros raised his eyebrows. "Oh, I don't understand," Sloane said. "He seemed to be expecting me to react in a particular way, and I didn't. That's why I haven't been back." "That's probably a wise decision," he said. "Children having uncontrollable magic is quite rare. If it were more common, we might not need siphons to channel magic at all. So those few talented children were the only ones they summoned when they were looking for the chosen one of Genetrix. If you didn't react to that information, it's an indicator that you aren't from around here." "He wouldn't suspect the truth, though, right?" she said. She felt an odd pressure against the sides of her head, like she had just dived to the bottom of a swimming pool. "Unlikely," Kiro said. "People here know there are other dimensions, but they don't know that they are accessible." Sloane pressed her fingers to her temples. The pressure still hadn't gone away. "What is it?" Kiro said, setting a gentle hand on her shoulder. "I don't know. I just feel like something is wrong," Sloane said. And that was when something behind them exploded. The onset of the drain was sudden. A change in pressure. And then, in the space of a blink, the tornado. A wall of opaque debris from street to sky. Only it wasn't wind. It was something else. Whipcords of energy that dragged everything in their path into the center of the funnel. And while people were moving toward that point, the core of the destructive force, they came apart, piece by piece, vivisected by magic. Sometimes too quickly for the body to catch up and die, so a person's last moments were spent in segments. The first time Sloane had gotten close to a drain, she had turned and run away. All of them had. There were no thoughts of bravery when the drain was coming. There were no thoughts at all. There was only survival. She had considered running away from Eris, fleeing the country and the Dark One. But the prophecy had tied her to him. And when her own honor failed her, that fact kept her in Eris's employ. If she fled the Dark One, he would find her, because she was chosen. So, because escape was not possible, Sloane learned not to turn and run. She ducked under Kiros's outstretched hand and grabbed Esther's arm right below the elbow. Esther's arm twisted as she grasped Sloane in the same place, locking them together. Cyrielle was screaming, her hair askew and her cape blown back. The Mandarin-sized gold pin now up against her throat. "Retreat! Three groups!" Matt shouted. "Perrin and Ciriel. Sloane, Esther, and Kyros. Me and Edda. Sloane, you there?" The question made her chest ache. Sloane nodded. It was a familiar procedure. Never go near a drain with more people than you had weapons. Don't rush into a fight. Live to fight again. They were tenets she had worked into her muscles, mapped into her brain. "Eyes open. Meet back at the camel." Matt cast a wild look over his shoulder as the group split into thirds. Sloane couldn't think of him. Couldn't think of anything except the rush of concrete and steel and flesh and earth ahead of them. Sloane's grip on Esther shifted as she took the lead. She bent low, pressing against the power that tried to throw her back. She had learned the way the drain felt, how it pushed you until it pulled you, how the pressure in her head would release when she had gotten too close, how it smelled like ozone and dust at first, then wet earth and blood. She checked behind her for Kyros, who had his siphon outstretched, fingers spread wide. Eyes open. The only real thing they had known about the drains before they encountered one was that the Dark One had been spotted at each one, meaning he likely had to be present to control them. And though he was a being of great magical power, he was also still a man. Where their own magic failed, they had reasoned knives and bullets would do the job just as well. They looked for him. Maybe they could find him. Maybe they could kill him. Sloane rounded a corner and ran down an alley toward the funnel. As she watched, the drain inhaled a huge wave of water from Lake Michigan and sent it scattering. Some of it escaped the thrust of the drain's power and splattered out, wetting the street, the brick walls of buildings that hadn't yet crumbled, and Sloane's cheeks. She took one step too far, and the drain's magnetism tugged at her legs and arms. She lurched away, knocking Esther back. "Left!" she shouted. She could hardly hear herself over the roar of magic and power, the screams of those caught in the drain's grasp, the hooting of car alarms and the wail of sirens. She jerked Esther to the side, back to the street, and Kyros tumbled after them both. She still couldn't see the drain's center, where the resurrectionist likely was, grounded by his own magic. He would be the eye of the storm, and to find him, to kill him, she would need to go somewhere open, one of the wider roads where she could see farther, unobstructed. Clark, Wells, Franklin, Wacker, she thought. The last street sign she had seen had been ripped from its moorings, but Warner Tower had been on Franklin, so it was only one block north to Wacker Drive. It was the smarter path to take, whether she saw the resurrectionist or not. Small streets were crowded, hard to navigate. She bent low and ran, pulling Esther behind her. The air was thick with dust. Sloane pulled the collar of her shirt up over her mouth and nose to keep from breathing it in. The sidewalks were now full of people running away from the drain, their faces in grimaces of horror, soot-stained and tear-streaked. The crowd was too dense to penetrate. Sloane led them to the middle of the street instead, where cars stood abandoned. She climbed over two taxis crushed nose to nose and sidestepped the back of a bus, the front of which had collided with a brick building. The seats inside were all empty, purses and briefcases abandoned on the floor. "Slow," Esther said between coughs. "Wacker," Sloane answered, and she almost laughed at the word despite herself. Her shirt clung to her back, soaked with sweat, and her legs burned as she climbed over another car. As she stepped on the hood, she saw that the driver was still behind the wheel, blood bubbling from his mouth. She stood for a moment, watching him. His chest was still. "Move on." She jumped down and found herself at the junction of Monroe and Wacker. Wacker Drive, the great double-decker confusion of Chicago, with its upper layer and its lower. Here it was, wide, with a landscaped, raised median, and tall buildings, titans of glass and steel, bracketed the road. Behind her was the spiral horn of Warner Tower and the twin prongs of the Sears Tower, and in front of her, the drain. As she watched, a woman in one shoe, hobbling away from a building entrance, stepped too close to the inexorable pull of the drain's power. A whipcord of energy upended her and dragged her, screaming, into the gray wall of destruction. But moving away from all the people and cars and uprooted trees and massive bricks of concrete was a solitary figure. The weight of inevitability settled on Sloane's shoulders. Cold crept up her spine. Through the cloud of dust and dirt, she saw a face plated with metal siphons, with only thin strips of pale skin visible at their seams. The hands that hung heavy at his sides were also metal-plated, as well as what she could see of his throat above the high collar of his robes. A hood covered his hair, and the rest of him was shrouded in the bulk of fabric. The Resurrectionist. "Retreat!" Esther screamed, her voice hoarse. But Sloane couldn't move. If the theory she had proposed to Esther and Matt after visiting Evan Kowalczyk, that the Resurrectionist was the parallel version of the Dark One, was correct, this was the man she had lived her entire life to kill. This was the man who had painstakingly broken Albie's body. This was the man who had tested Sloane's heart. "It's a simple choice, my dear."
"Sloane!"
She was barefoot in the Dark One's house. He had taken her boots. She had to find something heavy or something sharp. She saw a rock the size of her fist, a crumpled soda can, and in the planter, in the median, an old metal rod, the kind used for street signs. She picked it up. It was flaky, rusty in her palm, 2 feet long. She would need to be closer. She would need to swing hard, at his head, just to stun him so she could escape. She couldn't breathe. He was coming toward her, his steps confident, hand raised, as if in greeting, head cocked like a bird's. She was barefoot in the Dark One's house, and Albie was screaming.
"Sloane!"
Sloane screamed and charged, drawing the metal rod back like a baseball player with a bat. She swung, putting the full weight of her body behind it, and waited for the crack, the feeling of metal connecting with metal. But all she heard was a low, tinny note coming from the Resurrectionist's face mask. He flicked his fingers as if dismissing her, and the rod burst into a cloud that covered her palms with silver dust. Then his hand was lifting, closing into a fist. She remembered Kyros telling her the Resurrectionist's favored method of execution, collapsed lungs that wouldn't reinflate. Something heavy hit her from the side, sending her headfirst into the median. She saw dirt between her palms and used the momentum to propel herself over the planter and into the street on the other side of the barrier. Before diving into an alley, she looked over her shoulder. Kyros had taken her place in the street, his siphon hand held out and the air rippling in front of him as he let out a sharp, high whistle. But the Resurrectionist hissed through his mask, batted the barrier aside, and clenched a hand into a fist. Kyros choked and fell.
S,
Sloane tried to scream, but her throat felt like it was coated with sand. Esther was in the street, bent over Kyros's body. Sloane turned back with a strangled scream, but the Resurrectionist was already walking away from Kyros and Esther, and toward her. If there was one thing she had learned from her day of captivity, it was that when it came to the Dark One, she was the only bait he wouldn't fail to take. And it seemed to be the same with the Resurrectionist. She forced one foot back, then the other, stepping backward over abandoned high heels. A briefcase that had fallen open, its paper spilling all over the street. A half-eaten hot dog covered in relish, still in its wrapper. She stepped back faster, making sure the resurrectionist was still moving toward her and away from Esther and Kyros. Kyros, who was probably dead. She took another step back and ran into something solid. Sloane turned and saw a person. But the greenish skin had peeled away from its jaw, revealing a white streak of bone and the clench of teeth. Sloane watched a tongue work between them as the thing licked its pale, purplish lips. Not a person.
Is this the one?
A raspy, metallic voice. Yes. The answer came from a distance, with the same tinny sound as the note the resurrectionist had admitted to turn steel into dust. The dead thing moved fast, forcing a white cloth against Sloane's nose and mouth. She struggled against the inhumanly strong grip, but only for a moment. Then she passed out. Chicago Post. Chosen One. Still Alive? By Alexander Marshall.
Chicago, March 3. Are we doomed? Reads a sign propped against the City Hall building. A chosen truther, a member of a movement demanding transparency from the Department of Magical Oversight in Chicago regarding the Chosen One, has stopped for a cigarette. Chosen truthers have been protesting outside Cordis Center since Tuesday. Why? Because they think the Chosen One is dead. The nation celebrated the day Cordis announced it had found the Chosen One, destined to save humankind. But ever since the massacre of the Army of Flickering 3 years ago, the Chosen One has remained under lock and key. Perhaps it's not surprising that people are starting to speculate. What if he's dead? Asks Eleanor Green, mother of two from the Chicago suburb of Deer Grove. She's the founder of the Chosen Truth movement, though she reminds me several times that she's not the first one to want proof of the Chosen One's life. What if he died in the massacre and they just don't want to tell us? Has anyone seen him since then? Most of the Chosen Truthers hold signs that bear the illustration of the Chosen One that was released after he was discovered. Or allegedly discovered, as the Chosen Truthers would say. They told us they found him, says Althea Grange, a self-described neighborhood grandma from Rockford. And they told us he was too young to have his picture in the paper, and we should just trust them? I don't think they ever found him. They're just trying to avoid a mass panic. The Chosen Truthers have just begun to chant. Chosen One, Hidden One is the refrain of the hour. 2 hours ago, they were singing a parody of the R.E.M. song, It's the End of the World, with the lyrics, If it's the end of the world, we should know it. We know you're lying. Last night, they even brought in a minister to lead a prayer begging God to spare Genetrix. After days of protests in front of her office, Domo Deputy Director Aaliyah Haddix finally issued a response to the Chosen Truthers' concerns. This isn't some kind of conspiracy. After the massacre, we increased security around the Chosen One for his safety. He is still only 18 years old, and he deserves a little privacy until he's ready to come forward. They need to go home and find something else to worry about.
Chapter 26. Sloane was swaying her hips to the music. Her hands were caked with flour. Albie popped the top of the jar of sprinkles and tipped his head back to pour them in his mouth. Gross, Sloane said, still swaying. But she was laughing. In front of her was a line of cookies shaped like Christmas trees. She had dusted them with green sugar. Decorate your damn cookies, Sloane said. We're making a new tradition here. Albie's cheek bulged with sprinkles. His lips were blue from the food coloring. Then the color drained from his face, leaving him ashen and pale, a blue-lipped corpse. She woke up in waves. In the first, she noticed all the blood had rushed to her hands. Her fingertips were pulsing, and in the second, she realized her stomach was pressed into something hard and faintly curved. A shoulder. In the third, she remembered the cloth against her face. And in the fourth, she opened her eyes. There was fabric right in front of her. The hem of a shirt. She tipped her head up just a little to see the floor passing beneath her. It was checkerboard marble in taupe and white. Whoever, whatever, was carrying her wore brown work boots with untied purple laces. With her ear against his back, she could hear his breaths rattling in and out. The hand clasping her leg felt unyielding as a vise. She thought of the rotten cheek, the gritted molars with the tongue undulating behind them that she had seen before she passed out. Aelia had told them how the resurrectionist came by his name on Genetrix. His army was composed of the living dead. Her instinct was to thrash and kick, catch her captor by surprise, get away, and run as far as she could. But she didn't move. She didn't know enough about the one who was carrying her. Did he feel pain? How strong was he? And she didn't know where she was. Escape would have to wait. Instead of running, she took note of the direction of the light, coming from windows on her right, and its slant. They were facing east, and it was morning, just after sunrise. A sharp pain in her chest told her she was panicking. She had woken up a captive once before. It had gone badly. She listened to the murmur of voices around her, each one airy and dry like a gasp. The resurrectionist's army surrounding her. The echoes and the reflection of high windows in the gleaming floor told her the space was large. The scent on the air was mildew and dust, with a hint of the ozone the drain carried in on her clothes, hair, and skin. She knew from experience that it would take days to fade, no matter how hard she scrubbed, if she survived that long. She was still wearing her boots. That was something. An anchor to keep her here instead of in her memories. She had worn flippers in the dive. The dark one had taken her shoes. But here she had her boots. "She's awake," someone, or something, said. The voice came from her right. "Good," her captor grunted. "I'm tired." He released her legs and she crashed to the floor, her body battered by the tiles. She was in a long hall flanked by wide pillars and tiled with white marble. Geometric fixtures of blue glass hung in a line down the center of the hall. The tall windows on one side of the room were boarded up with plywood, except for the top row of glass. Across from them, on the other wall, a line of morning sunlight glinted on tiny golden tiles. Her elbows ached from hitting the ground so hard. She rolled over so she was on hands and knees and breathed through her nose as the pain subsided. She had been right about the resurrectionist's army surrounding her. They were in every direction, standing in clusters or sitting with their backs against the wall, talking. They were dressed in uniforms. Rich navy slacks and shirts with high collars, capes pinned at the shoulder by gilded buttons. If not for the unnatural greenish tint of their skin and the patches of rot on their faces and hands and throats, she might have thought they were just soldiers. Sloane stood. The man, if he could be called that, who had been carrying her was tall and broad, with milky blue eyes and only one ear. The woman with the bone-bare jaw who had knocked her unconscious was standing behind him, her dark, fraying hair worn in a braid over one shoulder. Sloane tasted bile. "Move," the man said. She wanted to do as she was told. She really did. But her legs were shaking, so she just stood there staring at them both. The woman rolled her eyes, grabbed Sloane's elbow, and dragged her forward. Sloane's shoes squeaked as she walked down a hallway of broken tiles and peeling paint, and up a metal staircase. The higher and deeper she went into the building, the less likely it was that she could escape. She tried to make a map in her mind. West. You're walking west. But it was all she could do to focus on her boots. Boots mean now. Bare feet means the past. The woman stopped in front of a door and unlocked it with a key from the ring on her belt. Inside was a disintegrating laboratory. All the walls were painted azure, as was the front of each drawer and cabinet door, all of them dangling precariously from the lab table in the center of the room. The floor, wood under linoleum, was buckling in places and covered with bits of plaster and flakes of blue paint. It wasn't a cell, not really. That was good. That meant it wasn't supposed to keep her in. That meant there was a way out. The woman shoved her into the laboratory and shut the door behind her. Sloane listened as she turned the lock, then walked the perimeter of the room, getting a sense of its size. It was empty except for the lab table in the middle and a faucet on the back wall. She went to it. There was a pipe beneath it that must have gone to some kind of sink drain, but the sink was gone. She turned on the water. It hissed for a moment before spraying a few orange drops in every direction, then spewing yellowish water that likely wasn't safe to drink. But she was covered in dirt and dust from the drain and desperate to smell less like death. She stripped off her coat and turned it inside out so she could tear off one of the pockets with her teeth. It would make a good washcloth. She scrubbed at the backs of her hands with the balled-up cloth until they were almost the right color, then rinsed out the pocket and used it on her face. She scrubbed until her cheeks tingled, then moved on to her throat and neck. Last was her hair, which made the water run black. She turned off the faucet and wrung out her hair, then tied it in a knot at the back of her head so it wouldn't get in her way. She wrapped herself in the coat, rubbing her arms to generate some warmth. The water had chilled her. Or maybe she was just afraid. She crouched with her back against the lab table, facing the door, and took the deepest breaths she could manage. It had gone this way before, waking in a strange place, and having to wait there until her captor, the Dark One, decided to do something. Falling asleep out of sheer exhaustion. She didn't know what had happened to her before she was taken to the room while she was unconscious. And she wasn't sure how long he had stood at her bedside watching her before touching her face to wake her. The lost time had plagued her more than she would have expected it to. The idea that her body had no memory of its own, that she could not interrogate it for the answer. She stayed crouched there, counting each breath so she could be sure that time was passing, until her feet went numb. She was just standing up to get her blood moving again when a key turned in the lock. Sloane backed up fast, moving until she hit the boards that covered the window frame. Her chest ached. She couldn't hear anything but the whisper of the Dark One saying her name. The Resurrectionist stood in the doorway, the living dead woman visible just past his bulky shoulder. Nero had said that the Resurrectionist wore 5 siphons. He had miscounted. There was one over each of the man's eyes, one over his nose and mouth, one on his throat, a siphon for each hand, one over an ear. Each one was plain, made of dark metal that looked like pewter. He had a loping gait, not quite a limp, unstable and predatory. He made a flicking gesture paired with a sharp whistle, and the door slammed behind him. They were alone. Her vision was going dark at the edges. She felt a tingling in her chest, in her hands. The same sensation she'd had when she encountered the needle in the sunken Sakhalin and the magical weapon in the dome. Whoever and whatever the resurrectionist was, he was suffused with magic. Ziva was the one who noticed. His voice was distorted by the siphon and had that tinny quality she had noticed on the street when he'd whistled. He spoke as if they had been in the middle of a conversation. All those sorcerers in their fine clothing scurrying about like rats. Something going on, clearly. He cocked his head. I have eyes wherever I need them. And the things the eyes said about you. No siphon. Always in the company of that hulking soldier. The one you killed, you mean? The question came out hot and fierce. She drew a harsh breath. No apparent knowledge of our world. He continued as if he hadn't been interrupted. Are you hyperventilating? Fuck you, Sloane said, her fingers curling into the paint and plaster. No magic, not even when you had no other choice, he said. Does that mean you can't use it? I wonder. He tilted his head to the other side. But why would they summon a soldier from another dimension to kill me if she couldn't use magic? The plaster bit into the skin under her fingernails. He knew. He knew where she was from, what she was meant to do. But how? She remembered the look in Mox's eyes at the bar. How he had been waiting for something she hadn't given him. I have eyes wherever I need them. Mox had been the resurrectionist's eyes, rescuing her from the snare, luring her to the tankard, then asking enough questions to figure out she was in the wrong world. Sloane cursed herself. She had been so stupid. Aelia and Nero wanted her to stay inside, stay safe, but she had been confident, cocky, a child playing at heroics. And now she would die for it. It would have been simple to end it. But then, the others, the resurrectionist said. How many are there? If you touch them, Sloane said, launching herself off the wall, I'll hit me with a pipe that turns to dust. He said, voice turning unctuous. You aren't being fair. You and your friends come to kill me, and I'm not allowed to fight back. You're destroying this world, she said. And my world. What's fair about that? Destroying the world. Me. He laughed darkly. I should be flattered, I suppose, that you think I can control that level of destruction while having a street fight. Sloane thought of his dark silhouette against the turbulent blur of the drain. It had not ceased even for a moment as he took Kyros down and chased her. This world, your world, they destroy themselves. All worlds do. He was shifty, restless even, with the weight of siphons anchoring him. They don't need me. Is that how you justify it? How are you being compensated? He said. Pennies. Nickels and dimes. Power to take back with you. What? Compensated. Ah, you're a true hero, then. He sounded almost amused. Scandalized by the mere mention of an exchange. I didn't choose to come here, she said. And if I could get myself home, I would be gone already. But it didn't seem like he heard her. He jerked his head to the side, like he was listening to something in the distance. Then he wheeled around and stormed out of the room. The door slammed shut behind him. Sloane was still for a while after he left. Her fear had settled to a low flame. She knew the Dark One. She knew the gritty feeling of being near him. The twist of her gut when his focus found her. Didn't she? Enough. She thought, and she turned to the boarded window behind her. It was her best chance at escape. Wood broke, boards burned. Windows opened up to ledges and streets and the cold night air. She started pulling out drawers and opening cabinets. They were made of flimsy plywood, and time had made them brittle. Good kindling, maybe, but that didn't help her unless she wanted to burn the room down around her. Still, she pulled the drawers free of their tracks and stacked them on top of the table. They were assets. Blunt force was the first thing to try. She picked up one of the larger drawers and swung it hard at the window boards. The drawer shattered, leaving Sloane holding only the drawer pull and half the front panel. She tossed it aside. There were gaps between the boards in the window that were wide enough for her fingers. She grabbed one of the boards and put her feet up on the wall to give herself leverage. Sloane pushed with her feet as she pulled with both hands at the wood, straining with all her strength to break it or even loosen it. But nothing. Her hands ached, and she swallowed a frustrated scream. She was not going to die here. Not in a rotten room in a parallel dimension. What she needed, she thought, was more pressure than her body could apply, which she could accomplish with either more force, something she couldn't get her hands on right now, or a smaller surface area. Sloane stared at the boards for a few seconds, praising whatever had set the laws of the universe and also empowered her to remember them. Then she stood next to the drain pipe sticking out of the wall. The slipknot that held the drain extension to the U-shaped trap was old, simple to loosen with her hand. She held on to the drain flange and pulled hard. The piece, inlet, flange, and trap separated from the extension and the escutcheon plate against the wall. The pipe was solid, heavy. She put it on the table. She wriggled out of her coat and unbuttoned her shirt, ignoring the sudden chill. Once the shirt was off, she put the coat back on and buttoned it up to her throat. She twisted the shirt into a rope and shoved the tail of it through the gap between the boards. It was annoying work, like threading a needle when you couldn't keep your hands steady. Even with her fingers stuck through the gap on either side of the board, she couldn't maneuver the makeshift rope to pull it through the other gap. She tried again and again, missing the fabric each time. Sweat was starting to bead on the back of her neck. The longer she spent doing this, she thought, the more likely it was that someone was going to interrupt her. Finally, she caught the rope on the other side of the board. Then she had to do it again. She needed to use two boards against each other, like the bars of an old-fashioned prison cell. It was easier the second time to maneuver the rope. She brought the end out on the other side of the second board and tied the two shirt ends together in a tight knot. She then grabbed the pipe, worked it through the center of the knot, and started turning it. At first, she didn't notice a change. But the more she turned the pipe, the tighter the shirt fabric became around the boards, and soon it was difficult to turn the pipe at all. Sloane had to climb up, bracing herself on the window ledge, and force the pipe down as hard as she could. Her hand throbbed, but the boards were starting to creak. Another turn, and the skin of her palms was starting to peel. The boards groaned. Another turn, and they cracked. Laughing, Sloane worked at the shirt knot to free the pipe, then used it to press into the weak spot in the boards, which were easier to bend now that she had made them give. Soon she had made a gap in the boards big enough for her body to fit through, but only just. She would have to crawl out. Getting her head through was simple enough, though the broken wood scraped her scalp. It was still day, but the sun was getting low. The building had tiers like a wedding cake, so she was above a lower level, the top covered in gravel. She wasn't sure how she would get down from that roof, but at least she could drop to the gravel without cracking her skull. She forced her way through the boards, biting her lip to keep from screaming when the wood dug into her shoulders on either side. She sucked in her stomach hard, wriggled the rest of the way through, then toppled to the gravel roof, aching. She knew better than to celebrate. She stood, brushed gravel off her clothes, and limped along the edge of the roof as she looked for a fire escape. Freedom was so close, just 7 stories down, but out of reach unless she wanted to break her back. The Sears Tower was in full view, a dark giant against the clouds, and the Warner Tower wasn't far from it, the ripples of its western side reflecting gray back at her. She was facing the lake, and the building she was in sat on top of what would be Congress Parkway back home. She had driven beneath this building but didn't know what it was called. Sloane walked the perimeter of the lower roof, but there was no ladder to be found. If she was going to escape, she would need to go back through the building. At the other end of the roof was what she assumed was a stairway bulkhead with a door. It would likely lead to a stairwell not dissimilar from the one she had discovered in the camel. If she was lucky, she would be able to get all the way to the first floor of this building, and then she could make a desperate run for it. Sloane forced the door open. Either it had been left unlocked or the lock had broken, and stepped into a dark stairwell that smelled like rot. She felt her way to a railing and held it tightly as she descended. It had been a long time since she'd had food or water. Her mouth was so dry it was starting to feel fuzzy. But she kept going, holding the thought of a glass of water in front of her like a carrot on a string. She had made it past 5 landings when a light came on. Sloane jumped back against the wall, letting her eyes adjust. She heard footsteps, people talking, close and getting closer, as whoever they were climbed up the stairs. She went carefully down the last few steps to the door and tried to tuck it open without making too much noise. But it was too heavy for that. She would need to pull harder. Sloane counted down in her head, then yanked the door open. The hinges screeched, and she sprinted into the hallway beyond, where the linoleum was buckling just as it had been in the laboratory that had served as her cell. Huge chunks of plaster were pulling away from the walls, and in broken bits on the floor, and half the ceiling tiles were missing or dangling precariously overhead. She passed doors that opened to old offices with maroon carpeting and fluorescent lights. Charts still hung on one office's wall, tracking sick leave trends in blue marker. She looked out one of the few remaining windows to figure out which direction she was going. She spotted the Sears Tower, nearer now than it had been when she was on the roof, which meant she was moving north, closer to where she had first come in, closer to the Resurrectionists' army. She heard something behind her and ducked into one of the offices to hide, except it wasn't quite an office. Not anymore, at least. The walls that outlined cubicles and nooks were still there, but the debris had been cleared from the floor. In one corner was a mattress with a sheet patterned with faded flowers and a matching pillowcase. Stacked next to the pillow were a few books, only one of which she recognized. The Manifestation of Impossible Wants. On one of the built-in desks near the front were neat piles of screws, wires, metal plates. In a box under the desk were old siphons in various stages of disrepair. One missing all the plates that would cover the palm, another missing all the fingers. A variety of screwdrivers were in a jar nearby, handles up, waiting to be used. This was where someone lived. She didn't know much about zombies, or whatever the proper term for the Resurrectionists' soldiers was, since they seemed too intelligent to be actual zombies. But she doubted they needed to sleep. So if this was anyone's bedroom, it was the Resurrectionists, which meant she couldn't have chosen a worse hiding place. She heard voices again. Sloane slipped into another room that had clearly been a meeting space, judging by the long rickety table and the abundance of windows. These weren't boarded completely, giving her light to see by. In fact, she was fairly sure she could open one. Sloane wiggled the window by its handle, testing how loose it was in its frame. It shifted back and forth. She looked over her shoulder and paused to listen to the voices, They had gotten louder. She made out a few words.
Stitch it back on, but...
Fuck, she whispered, and she shoved the window up as hard as she could. It slammed up in its frame, and she stuck her head out. She was 2 stories up, high enough that she would break a leg if she jumped. She looked over her shoulder again. She couldn't see anything, but the voices had stopped. Sloane held her breath as she waited. There was a whine, the pressure of a foot against an old floor, the squeak of linoleum. Okay, she whispered to herself. Okay, okay, okay. She put her legs through the window and positioned herself on the windowsill. Then, bracing herself for pain, Sloane jumped. Sloane didn't look down at her right ankle. She didn't want to know. Her eyes swam with tears. She bit down on her fist and limped as fast as she could, leaning against the alley wall for support. In a few yards, she would run out of wall, and she would have to put all her weight on her right foot. Sloane stopped to wipe her eyes. She felt like someone was stabbing a knife repeatedly into her right leg. All her thoughts pulsed in time with the aching. She stepped away from the corner and screamed.
One more step,
she told herself, gasping, even though she was at least 100 paces from the river, where there was a railing she could put a hand on. She looked behind her, through a haze of tears, to see if any cars were coming. She saw nothing. Sloane stepped again and again. She walked all the way to the river, where she finally saw headlights.
Excerpts from At Long Last, a collection of essays about the Chosen One. From the essay Like a Dream by Laura Bryant. And it was there, watching my groceries spill across the street, the onion rolling into the gutter, a bottle of milk broken and spilling into the cracks in the sidewalk, that I first saw him. The resurrectionist's destructive gale had begun. The pull, the shredding, chewing of matter. And all around it, people screaming, screaming, running, running for their lives. I had toppled, twisting my ankle. One of the weaker ones of the herd, now vulnerable to attack by our world's most horrific predator, our would-be destroyer, our devil made flesh. My death was certain, and yet, like a dream, the Chosen One came forth, golden hair glinting in the sun, the seal of the army a flickering beneath his shoulder, a tribute to his fallen comrades, his massacred men. A simple metal cuff around his throat, his siphon, his sword. A whistle clamped between his teeth, his shield. A new army, rebuilt on the ashes of the dead, at his back. Our defender. The chosen one of Genetrix.
From the essay, My First Thought, by Zevera Ibáñez. I saw a picture of him in the newspaper the day after the attack on Cordis. He had fought, sung powerful workings into being, shaken windows, rattled doors in their frames. But he hadn't won, and he hadn't lost. He was still among us, so we were glad. But we were disappointed, too. That he had not saved the world with one whistle. It meant that more anguish awaited us, more streets split down the middle, more stone-faced mothers, children walking alone, men sitting on curbs and staring at nothing, more buildings torn apart by supernatural wind, more picking through rubble, torn curtains, shattered windows, more of all of this, more losing. More of having less. I saw a picture of him standing next to a stop sign, golden hair, golden chain around his neck, golden band across his throat, lips pressed together, cheek dimpling, hand clasped in the mayor's hand in greeting. My first thought was, I thought he would be taller.
Chapter 27. Sloane limped into the street, waving her arms. The taxi screeched to a stop, and she opened the door before the driver could decide she wasn't worth the trouble. The driver, a clean-shaven, pale man in his early 20s, twisted in his seat to look at her. She propped her leg up next to her. "Ma'am," he said, eyes wide. "Are you?" "I need to go to the Cordis Center," she said. "I've got to take you to the hospital, ma'am." "No," Sloane said, teeth gritted. She didn't want to navigate a genetrix hospital by herself. "And if you call me ma'am again, I'm going to tuck and roll out of this car." Sloane stared at the charms dangling from the rearview mirror for most of the drive back. A Saint medal, half of a heart, a tiny plastic whistle. The radio was set to a Christian station, and one song's chorus, "Jesus, you did a working on my heart," made her feel very far from home. It was only when the car pulled up to the curb in front of the building that she remembered she didn't have any money. She was bickering with the driver at greater and greater volume when Cyrielle ran outside. Sloane had never been more relieved to see bright orange lipstick. "Oh my God," Cyrielle said as Sloane stuck her swollen, very swollen ankle out of the car. Cyrielle took a coin from the sack at her waist and thrust it at the taxi driver, then put an arm around Sloane to help her out of the car. Sloane realized only then that she had done it. She had escaped. She let herself relax once they were inside the Camel. Cyrielle sat her down on a bench near the main entrance, and Sloane watched orange diamonds scattered across the floor as the sun burned through the tiny panes of glass above her. The air was warm, and people rushed back and forth in front of her, stomping in heavy boots or snapping in fine pointed shoes, or squeaking in sneakers with marshmallow white soles. Her right foot was bare. She had taken off the boot in the taxi upon realizing that the leather was pinching at her massive ankle and turning purple. She hardly felt the pain anymore. Something pricked at her attention. She lifted her head to see Matt, half walking, half running across the lobby. His eyes were red. He had been crying. When their eyes met, he burst into a run, almost bowling over an old lady with tight gray curls. Sloane used the wall to push herself to her feet, just in time for him to collide with her. His arms wrapped around her middle, and he lifted her to her toes. It felt good to have his solid body against hers. The last time they had slept together, she hadn't appreciated it enough. Not just because Matt was all lean, finely tuned muscle, but because he was warm and familiar and kind. For the past few years, he hadn't exactly set her alight, but she had burned for him low and steady. She missed it, that fire, a pilot light that never went out. Her hands had come up automatically to the middle of his back, which was damp with sweat. He set her down gently but didn't let her go. It struck her suddenly that he was trembling. "Hey," she whispered into his ear. "It's okay. I'm okay." It was, all I could think was. His voice was muffled by her shirt. He had buried his face in her shoulder. "All I could think was, not again. Not again." She had been thinking the same thing since they'd gotten to Genetrix. Not again. Not another dark one. Not another kidnapping. Not another escape. But she hadn't thought about what it might be like for Matt to watch her taken away a second time.
not knowing if he would ever see her alive again, not knowing what she was enduring. She hadn't actually thought about what he went through the first time either. Matt had been the leader of their group, unquestionably, and two of the people he led had been taken and tortured by their enemy. There was no way he hadn't blamed himself for it. He probably blamed himself now. Sloane turned her face toward Matt's and spoke into the small space that separated them. "It wasn't the same," she said. She ran her hand over his short hair. "No one hurt me, okay? I'm fine. Just really smelly, probably." A gurgle of a laugh, somewhat hysterical, was Matt's response. He relaxed his grip on her, and she offered him a small smile. She felt the first flicker of hope since she had returned the ring to him. Hope that one day, when the pain dulled, they might be friends again. Esther was waiting a few feet away. She had discovered Genetrix textiles, and she was wearing them all at once. A paisley scarf around her shoulders, draped low enough to reveal her throat siphon. A checkerboard blouse, pinstriped pants, orange herringbone socks. When Matt and Sloane separated, she came forward and hugged Sloane a little more delicately than Matt had. "Kyros," Sloane said as Esther pulled away. The name came out soft. She could hardly stand to say it. "Alive, but not conscious. They're not sure he'll ever wake up. I did a working. The breath got his lungs going again," Esther said, a sharp glint in her eyes that looked like pride. An ache in Sloane's chest eased a little. She hadn't been able to think of Kyros since she was taken. But the sight of him falling at the resurrectionist's hand hadn't left her. "You're hurt?" Matt said, pointing to her bulbous ankle. "Jumped out a window to escape," Sloane said. "Pretty sure I need a doctor, or maybe a new leg." "Cyrielle went to get one. A doctor, not a leg," Matt said. Sloane hadn't even noticed that Cyrielle was gone, but there was no orange haunting the edges of her vision. "She said someone could come to you." "Good." Esther stood on Sloane's left, Matt on her right. Both wrapped their arms around her waist to support her as she hobbled toward the elevator bank. She hardly even needed to put her feet on the ground. Esther sang the right note to summon the elevator. There was relief in this too, that despite what she had kept from them, and despite what they had all been through, they were still with her. Not all was lost. That night, she dreamed about stumbling barefoot across a field, her arm wrapped around Albie's waist as he wheezed in her ear. Her arm was slippery with his blood. She stopped, adjusting her grip on his body. Albie screamed into his teeth. It was dark, but she knew it was morning by the dew on the grass. It wet her ankles. She woke with a throbbing jaw from gritting her teeth and swallowed her last benzo. 2 days later, Sloane found herself in Alia's office with crutches tucked under her arms. The doctor had set up his equipment in Sloane's sparse room the night before and crouched at the foot of the bed with her foot in his lap. He had an elaborate whistle between his teeth, a modified oscilloscope that told him the frequency of the sound he made to the third decimal place, and a siphon over his eye that looked like half a visor. He'd used all three in concert, puffing the whistle to find the pitch on the oscilloscope, and then gesturing to begin the working that let him see the break in her bone. In the haze of her sleep deprivation, it had felt like a holy ritual. He had set the bone with strong, cold hands and little apology, and promised a cast the following day, and a siphon that would speed the healing of her bones. Now, both siphon and cast were wrapped around her leg, and she'd been told to use crutches for 2 weeks. She was scrubbed clean of the soot and dirt of the drain, but the feeling clung to her still, like a lucid dream. Alia's office was, in a word, clean. Wood floors, white walls, a single shelf with color-coded books. There were white orchids in large white planters by the window. The door closed behind Sloane with a heavy thump. She had passed by Nero's workshop on the way to Alia's office, and his doors were the same, thick and wooden, with heavy metal hinges and knobs locked by magic. Their intimidating appearance made her wonder what was kept in the two spaces that required such tight security. Sloane still caught phantom whiffs of sulfur every few minutes, even though her hair now smelled